Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, coming to you jet-lagged from Singapore, and joining me in Simon Lambert in London today is some random Simon we just met on the street. Someone called Lee Boyce, I think. Don't know if he's any good, but anyway. Coming up, the Prime Minister scrapped them. His opponent is promising to bring them back. So what is the deal with house building targets? Do they work? And what is up with the industry generally? If you're in the fortunate position to buy, what do you do? Do you wait for either house prices or mortgage rates to fall first, or do you just plow on? Also today, the government finally seems to be taking scams seriously. But the proof, says Lee Boyce, will be in the pudding. Plus, they've only gone and done it. Savings rates breach 5%. We take a look at what's on offer. Don't forget to stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Don't forget, you can stay on top of what's going on in the markets by tuning in to the Digest and Invest podcast by eToro. Go to your regular podcast platform and listen on the go. Digest and Invest by eToro, the podcast for those interested in trading and investing.
But first, house building targets. Rishi Sunak scrapped them. Keir Starmer is vowing to bring them back. The Labour leader says he wants to build 300,000 homes a year and boost ownership rate to 70%. But can he succeed where others have failed? In not just numbers, but in quality. It comes as Housing Secretary Michael Gove is being taken to court for blocking a development for being poor quality and ugly. But first, house building. For years, we've had political pledges on the number of new homes that will be built, and yet here we are. Some house builders are even planning to scale back their projects after some poor trading results across the board. An overview, if you would. What's wrong with house building, Lee Boyce? Welcome back.
Hi, Georgie. Thank you. I think one of the big problems with house building is there is that issue around quantity. So this 300,000 target gets banded around all the time. It's all well and good, but what about the quality of what's being built? And I think that that's where lie the problem. And then you have lots of towns where you could already argue are pretty filled. There's a lot of people. And a lot of these new builds go up, and does the infrastructure grow with it? You know, do we get new roads? Do we get new schools? Do we get new doctor surgeries? All of that kind of thing. And there's a lot of, you know, things at play. So when we talk about this 300,000 target, I think it's just a little bit silly. I think what would actually make more sense is thinking about it on a regional basis, probably a county by county basis, and saying, do you know what, how many new homes need to go up in this county, and where can they go, and where can we repurpose land and potentially, you know, not harm the environment? And the type of homes that we build, you know, we always talk about the kind of the size of them compared to other countries, and it does feel like they've gotten smaller, and there's these houses just get bunged in all sorts of places. In the last few weeks, I've just driven around all sorts of rural parts of Essex, and there's land for sale, some land that's gone and said there's going to be residential properties there. And I sort of look over and it looks like a swampland. And I just think, is that the most sensible place to build homes? So look, it's always been one of those political hotbeds. There's a lot of people in towns, cities, places that go, oh, we don't want more new builds being banged up here. But then you have the demand of people wanting to buy their own home. That figure that Keir Starmer said about wants 70% of home ownership. It's currently at 64%. So it's not outside the realms of possibility that that could happen. I think there was around about 190,000 new builds registered last year. So that's quite a far away from that 300,000 figure. But as I say, for me, and I think a lot of people feel this, it's just where do they go? Where do you build these homes? Because let's face it, a lot of the demand is in the southeast, for example. Southeast already feels like it's quite a traffic heavy place to live. And people look at these new build estates and go, you're banging up 500 homes there. Well, the traffic is already a nightmare. I already can't get a doctor's appointment. The school, all the good schools already oversubscribed. So you've got to be joking me. And then you have years of disruption. And then this story this week, I think it's absolutely, is Michael Gove the good guy? Is that what's happening? I don't know. So basically, this story is that he's blocked a development in Kent, which of course is the Garden of England. It's a beautiful county, very nice place. And this is in an area of outstanding natural beauty. And he believes that the homes, Michael Gove this is, believes that the homes that are being built there are basically ugly. And he was talking about this last year, about he had powers to stop new builds springing up if he thought they were ugly. And this first time he's kind of turned around and actually used those powers. And there's some people in our story saying this is great news. You know, they didn't want these homes going up there. But at the same time, homes need to be built. So what you know, where is the trade-off? So it's a really difficult one, and I don't know the answers. I always think that that 300,000 target, though, is just, I'm not a big fan.
See, is the problem with targets, is it not, Simon? That becomes the only thing to think about, the number, not the quality necessarily. But actually, we haven't reached the number. We've spoken on the podcast for how many years are we going now? Almost a decade. Every year we're saying they're not hitting their targets, they're not getting the right number of homes. What is the right number of homes? How short are we?
Targets are not the answer to this problem. The answer to this problem is convincing people that they want homes to be built in their area. And if you want to convince people that they want homes to be built in their area, then you need to focus on certain things. Largely, I think they're concerns, because people see new build housing as low quality, not built for them, not built for their local community. The housing, new build housing market is dominated by about six or seven very large companies: Barratt, Taylor Wimpey, Persimmon, Bellway, Vistry, Berkeley, and Redrow. They build houses all across the country. Some of them are more focused in some areas, some of them more focused in others. What they arguably are not focused on is the quality of life of the people already living in those local areas. The way that we do housing developments in this country is often that we fail to build them in town centres where they are close to the schools, the train stations, the amenities, and we tend to manage to shoehorn some land on the outside of a town or an area, which is often fields, green belt. There's some debate as to high quality green belt, low quality green belt, but it's quite often countryside. The landowner sells the land, makes a huge profit at the stroke of a planner's pen. The developer builds the houses, sells them at a premium to what it would cost you to buy a house, a second-hand house, if you want to call it that, a house on the normal property market. They don't bring down prices. They're sold at more expensive prices. And often they are identikit. If you get in your car or get on the train and you travel around England, you will find housing developments going up on the outskirts of towns across the country, and they all look pretty much the same. The kind of, if I'm going to be honest, a bit bland. They don't really add much. There's not a lot of really good planning going on here. They've got some parks and some green spaces, but it all looks a bit windblown and everything. And what it does is it creates a scenario where the people who live in those towns get pushed further away from the countryside. And we saw within the pandemic how much people value access to the countryside and things like that. They also complain, like Lee said, that they can't get a GP appointment, that it takes them hours when they go to the hospital, if they need to go to the hospital, that their trains are full, that their roads are full, that their schools are full, all these other things. So how do you manage to convince those people that you need more houses? Well, you need to tackle those problems. So you need to tackle the problem of people's perception of rubbish developments, small homes with tiny gardens, landowners cashing in at the stroke of a planner's pen, little benefit to the local community, people being pushed further away from green space, the lack of infrastructure. Do you do that with a target? No, you don't do that with a target. Whatever the number of that target is, whether it's 300,000, whether it's 240,000, whether it's more, whether it's less. Also, I mean, high house prices are not a function of not building enough homes. High house prices are a function of decades of cheap money and people being lent more and more money. There's been plenty of research into this. None other institution than the Bank of England themselves pointed out that actually most of the house price inflation came from low interest rates. So it is a bit murky. And then also you get to the number of the target, as you said, 300,000. Where did that number even come from? That number was in the 2019 Conservative Manifesto, a target for 300,000 homes a year by the mid-2020s, a point in time which we are rapidly approaching. The figure is for England, and it was actually unveiled by then-Chancellor Philip Hammond in 2017. who, I quote, he told BBC News, experts agree that 300,000 new homes a year would start to make inroads on the affordability of housing. Now, famously, Michael Gove said we'd had enough of experts, didn't we? And he's the man behind scrapping the target, although those two things are not directly related. But like, where did this 300,000 figure come from? Nobody even really knows. Now it's been bandied around by Keir Starmer. He's going to bring it back. There's arguments in the Tory party over it. The target under Gordon Brown was actually lower than that. He said that we wanted to do, I think it was 240,000 new homes a year. And in fact, actually, if you look at the figures in the 1970s, which is seen as a much better decade for house building, on average, almost 250,000 homes were built in England each year. But then if you look at the figures for, you know, going back to before the pandemic, all of a sudden you discover that actually net additional dwellings, which is how many new housing, you know, units you're getting, were running at just under 250,000 in the years running up to the pandemic. So for example, 2019 to 2020, 242,700 net additional dwellings. Now, what happened then? Well, obviously there was the COVID pandemic, which had a made a serious dent on house building. You've then seen a major shakeout of that. We've got inflation, we've got the cost of living crisis, we've got interest rates going through the roof, we've got American regional banks collapsing. So there might be some extenuating circumstances as to why house builders are building quite as many houses at the moment as they might be doing. But why aren't they doing it? Because they're worried that they're not going to make as much profit on the houses. So they're reining it in. And because people have less ability to pay the prices for them, there's less people buying those houses. So do we want to hark back to a target of 300,000 homes? Sorry, this is a very long way of getting to this. Do we want to hark back to a target of having 300,000 new homes when there has been a, hopefully a once in a lifetime event between that target being created and the point that we are now, i.e. the COVID pandemic, which is largely responsible for all of the chaos that we have seen over the last 3 years? And or do we want to go to a point where we go, actually, maybe this target thing wasn't working in the first place, and we need to work out why people who are concerned about their children and their children's children not being able to afford homes to live in, not being able to afford homes to rent, don't want more houses being built near them? And is there a better way of doing it with better quality developments, better quality planning, this idea of like hub and spoke, where you have the town and then you have the spokes that come out of it, and in between those spokes of housing, those spokes are green space, and you build the housing in between of it so everyone has access to green space? Are there better ways of doing it? Or should we just put in place a £300,000 target and say to the big house builders, fill your boots, knock up a load of low quality bland housing and flog it to people at high prices?
I'm suggesting that second one is not the answer. But Lee, there's a point that Simon made that it doesn't seem right that something as fundamentally important as where to live and homes being built, but obviously is being decided by companies. But if they don't think they're going to get any profit and they're just holding back, I mean, what do we do then?
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? I mean, raw materials are getting more expensive. The cost of building homes is getting more expensive. Mortgages have become way more expensive. So, you know, that's holding some people back. You know, new builds, quite often first-time buyers, for example, are snapping up new builds. And that's the thing. They're holding back. Well, who's going to fill the gap? And who's going to build these homes? And that is something I genuinely think needs to be sort of looked at, because there's rules around when these new build estates go up, for example, and a number of affordable homes, what gets labelled affordable homes. Now, the jury is out as how affordable some of these places are. So usually a certain percentage is billed as affordable housing. Now, if you've got only six really big players, there are smaller players, but the big players are so dominant. They're the ones that have the purchasing power to get the land and could build these places en masse. Surely there is an argument to be said that there should be a kind of closer look as to who are building these homes. How can we help smaller developers, maybe developers that have a kind of different vision as to what housing should look like. So I'm talking about things like, you know, homes that are kind of more fitting in an area. You know, this example in High Weald in Kent, where Michael Gove has stopped this, would it have been given the green light if they were more in keeping with the environment? You know, I don't want to kind of describe what these homes are like because I don't want to get myself in legal trouble and get sued by, you know, the developer. But generally, like,
yeah,
all new builds feel like and kind of look the same. Do you know what I mean? You go past one of those new build estates and they kind of just all look so vanilla and so kind of, I don't know, like eyesores sometimes, you know, a lot of the time. You know, is there an argument to be said that actually small scale developers should be perhaps getting more funding or, you know, something along those lines where they actually make these things more in keeping with the local area? There's a few big players that have a lot of power, and that's what it feels like. And if they say, actually, we're not going to build as many homes this year because of costs and we're not going to make as big profits, it's not great, is it?
Just a brief shout out to the area of Frant. I think it's East Sussex, and I can't remember who the house builder are, but they have built a load of homes there in keeping with the area. So there you go. But whoever built those in Frant, well done. Simon?
A lot of this is big house builders taking the easy option. And I think what's important here is that we do need to build more homes. We do need to build a certain number of homes per year. We need robust evidence as to why we have those targets and where those targets have come from. And it should be that not everybody in the country can bring it up off the top of their head. But, you know, there needs to be people need to know why there is a target. There's this big argument over local plans at the moment where councils have to come up with a plan and they have had it dictated to them by central government that they have to put a plan in place for a certain number of houses. There's loads of councils that don't have local plans. My own district council actually had its local plan thrown out and is still working on it despite its homework being about 4 or 5 years late. Maybe it's run by journalists. But there is this feeling of top-down, you know, dictation to areas. And we need to think a lot more carefully about how we do these things, because what's happening is all across the country, developers, the big developers, have bought land. Some small developers as well, but big developers have bought land, or they take options on land. And what that means is that then the landowners or the developer as an agent of them or another agent put that land forward for development. They might enter it into a call to sites in a local plan or something like that. And if they then get permission to build on that land, and we're talking about major housing developments in many cases, you know, 500 homes plus 1,000 homes or whatever, all of a sudden at the stroke of a pen, that land is worth a lot more money than it is as a field with some crops in it or some horses grazing on it or something like that. And the landowner gets a life-changing sum of money, lottery win type money. Mm. The developer gets to build the houses and it makes lots of money. And the local community gets some more houses, but they're going to be sold at a premium to the houses that are already on sale there anyway. That's just the way it works. There's been plenty of research done into this that proves it in the past. And if you want to find out more, Google Sir Oliver Letwin's report into this. And the local community sort of loses out. And often those houses are built pretty much as far away from the schools and the train station and the town centre as you could possibly get, because it's just easier to do it this way than it is to try and find land that's more central. It's easier to do it this way than to come up with new and interesting ways of doing planning. It's easier to do it this way, lay out the same kind of street grid of houses that you lay out everywhere and build the same houses that you pretty much build everywhere, because it's just cheaper to do it like that. You're sort of commoditizing it a bit. It's easier just to not really think about this. And this is what the system just plays into the hands of this. And then we wonder why we're not getting support for new housing or we're getting poor quality housing. And there needs to be a concerted effort to change this, I would argue, because I don't think really anybody is particularly happy with this. And we also need to look at things like modular homes, for example, where rather than the homes being built on site, the homes are built in a factory and they're shipped out to the site and they're put together, you know, in a modular fashion. It's like, you know, building a bit together and everything like that. And it actually means that you can build quite high quality houses, because being built in a factory, the different elements being built in a factory means that there's more precision that can go into it. And it's more like kind of, you know, factory manufactured rather than somebody doing some block work in the rain manufactured. But there's all these other things around it. And what I'd really like to see is all the politicians involved in this on all the different sides talking about all these different things, rather than just arguing with each other literally about a number that may possibly have been slightly plucked out of the air. And it goes back to the fact, actually, that often when developers do developments in town centres, often they'll be then marketed as luxury developments because they're close to the town centre, and the developer will get away with not putting the affordable housing in, and they will make a payment of money in lieu to the local council. And also, to go back to just one more thing, it was actually a good thing in Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party manifesto about changing this system whereby the landowner makes an absolute lottery winning mint at the stroke of a planner's pen, and making it so that quite a bit of that uplift in value goes back into the local community instead of going to the individual who owned the field in the first place. They still get an uplift, but they don't get the mega, mega uplift. And actually, that would seem a much fairer system, because it's the local community that are losing the green space around them and getting what they, many would argue, not so much in return, whereas it's the landowner getting the lottery win star money.
Indeed. Just before we move off from this, Simon, just a very brief one. Is there anything in Keir Starmer's target that he said that sort of reflects what you've just said there? I mean, have we got more detail? Is it genuinely well thought out plan here? Lots of detail, as we would expect.
To be fair to Keir Starmer, I think the origination of some of this was an interview that he did with The Economist.
Right.
And the interview was, in the style of an Economist interview, quite short on actual quotes from Keir Starmer and kind of longer on paraphrasing and background stuff like that. Right. So he's not, as far as I'm aware, actually elaborated so much on this. But it would be nice to see a scenario, actually, for all politicians when talking about anything, whereby instead of just like with this kind of headline number reporting kind of thing, they did elaborate on it slightly. Mm. We've talked about this with the, you know, various things. It's like, maybe if they could elaborate a bit more and put some more flesh on the bones, or if they haven't got the flesh on the bones yet, maybe they could hold off until they've got it before they start telling people about it.
Oh, Simon, I was about to say Simon for Prime Minister there, but you don't have the politicking down, Simon, I'm afraid. You need to play the game. Right, moving on, but sticking with property, if you are in a fortunate position where you can buy, you can find somewhere to buy and you've got the deposit, we've got a reader question time. I've been looking to get on the housing ladder, says your reader, since the start of the year. I've saved the deposit I need, but I'm waiting to see if mortgage rates or house prices will come down. I'm currently in a flat share. The rent is quite a bit cheaper than what the mortgage will cost me. So they want to know, do they keep waiting? Is it a good idea, given all the people in the news and on social media who say house prices are falling or that mortgage rates will begin to come down soon? They say, does this look likely to happen? And Lee Boyce, if so, when? Get your crystal ball out.
I don't know crystal ball gazing, Georgie. No, this is one of those things where it is just down to your individual circumstances, isn't it? If you're ready to buy a home and you have the deposit in place and you've gone through, you know, all of the ins and outs with a mortgage broker, which I'd recommend, you know, as a first-time buyer, you should have no doubts, really. You should just go for it, is my opinion. Because you could sit around and think, oh, house prices are going to fall. We had it at the start of the year, towards the end of last year, house prices are going to fall 10% this year. I mean, is that what's being reflected massively in the house price indexes at the moment? I'm not completely convinced. And then you have a look at mortgage rates. So an average five-year fixed rate mortgage for someone buying with a 15% deposit is currently 4.81%. A year ago, it was 2.59%. Now, that is a big, big uplift. Mm. But that is the average rate. You know, there is quite a large possibility that you'd be able to get a lower rate than that, especially if you do use a mortgage broker, for example. I think what's more important is, are you buying a home for the right reason? I.e., are you not sort of scraping around, you know, really sort of scratched around to get your deposit, and now you're buying something that's not going to be suitable for you, and something that's not going to be suitable for you, you know, for the next, you're going to outgrow it in the next 2 years, for example. I think that is probably the more poignant question. Are you buying it for buying its sake, or are you buying a home because it's somewhere that you can really see yourself living in for a long stretch of time? Now, house prices might fall this year. I'm making no daft predictions. I've got absolutely no idea. I feel like the house price indexes at the moment are a real mixed bag. It's almost impossible to kind of decipher what's going on. Actually phoned up some estate agents at the start of last month across the country for a story, and it was just in the new tax year, and these, honestly, I must have called a dozen estate agents, and at least three quarters of them were super busy. They were saying it was the busiest sort of first week of April that they'd seen for quite some time. Make of that what you will. It sounds like there are people out there looking to buy homes, as there always is. And it's that supply and demand thing. One thing that has cropped up this week, though, is the rumours of Help to Buy 2.0, which seems quite...
Explain.
Well, there have sort of been murmurings. Bearing in mind this wound down last year, it's almost like, we miss Help to Buy. Let's bring it back again. And basically,
well, it's Help to Buy 1.0, firstly, and then Help to Buy 2.0.
It's essentially, really, really simply put, is that you get help... a loan for part of the deposit of buying a home. That is it in a kind of really short and simple way. But the argument is that has helped pump up house prices, and relaunch of such a scheme, it could continue just to keep that trundling along. Does it really help a first-time buyer in the long run if you're buying at an even higher price? But again, going back to the reader question on this mortgage, I mean, when I bought a home 7 years ago, I was having the same kind of questions. You know, are house prices about to fall? Wow, this is a big amount of money to be borrowing. You know, it's the most amount of money you're likely to ever borrow in your life. And then you look at it and you look at the interest and you think, God, is this all worth it? But, you know, it's just down to your own circumstances. And if you're ready to buy, you're ready to buy. And unfortunately, yeah, rates have gone up compared to last year. But if you can afford a mortgage over a 5-year term at a certain level, then, you know, I think the key is just to not be overstretching yourself, not to be taking on absolutely monumental size mortgage payments if your, you know, wages don't match up to it. I mean, the rule of thumb is always borrow 4.5 times your salary, and if you're buying as a couple, you know, they can give you some relatively good purchasing power. But yeah, I'm, as I say, I'm not crystal ball gazing, and if you're listening to this and you're on the cusp of buying a first home, it's just worth speaking to a mortgage broker and just crunching all your finances and knowing it with a fine tooth comb.
Simon, any advice for our reader?
Well, I think Lee's right. I think you have to make a decision on what's right for you personally at the time. Making that decision based on worrying that you might lock into a higher mortgage rate for the next 5 years than otherwise might happen if inflation suddenly drops and rates suddenly fall is putting your life on hold to an extent for something that you can't really predict. Nobody knows what's going to happen. Mortgage rates could get cheaper from here. They could get more expensive. You could end up kicking yourself because they're more expensive. I've always said that the thing you need to look out for with a home, if you're buying with some uncertainty, is could you live there for the next 5 years? People often, when they buy their first home, they think quite short term. People think quite short term with homes anyway. They imagine themselves only living there for a few years, but actually on average people live in homes for much, much longer than that. 2 years passes far quicker than you think. 5 years passes far quicker than you think. And so you need to think about, you, as I said, your personal circumstances. And if it's that you're worrying about this and you're buying a one bedroom flat, but you've just got married and you might like to have children, then maybe hold off, because maybe you want to get somewhere that's got two bedrooms, because if you have a child, it's going to create you a problem because you can't really necessarily live there for the next 5 years. You could do, but you might find it's a bit of a squish. Or if you're buying a place that's plenty big enough and that you know that you can grow into, then you need to worry about it less. And the other thing that comes into play, of course, is the mortgage going to be cheaper than your rent? And maybe that's the kind of thing people should think about more. than whether interest rates are going to fall over the next 5 years. It's, will this actually just be saving me money compared to my rent? And does that make it a better proposition than sitting here renting whilst I wait to see what might or might not happen to interest rates?
Indeed. That's it for part one.
I'm joined now by Sam North of eToro for our weekly update on what's been happening on the markets. Sam, how's the past week been?
Busy. Very, very busy. Even though we had the shortened week here in the UK, it's been busy. It's been exciting. The main focus was on the FOMC. They raised rates by 25 basis points, which is now the highest it's been since September 2007. And they've done it the quickest that they have ever raised rates. We now expect them to pause. So no further rate hikes this year, and then to cut later on this year too. However, I imagine there's going to be many changes to expectations over the next few weeks and months. We've got inflation next week. That will be the next sort of piece of the puzzle. Other than that, this week, US regional banks were also in focus. Their share prices came under a lot of pressure due to the pricing in of contagion risk. That and negative talk about the US debt ceiling has got investors on edge. Elsewhere, ECB, small hike, 25 basis points, but they've kind of reiterated that they're not done yet, as we're sort of seeing the US are. Apple, the biggest company reporting this week, they beat estimates in their earnings, and their share price is the highest since August last year. I mentioned the last few weeks, I think a couple months of downside isn't out the question, and I still kind of feel that way. However, I do feel in the next, well, in the second half of the year, we're still going to finish higher than where we are now.
And what do we have to look forward to next week, apart from another bank holiday?
Yeah, which is what I'm looking forward to. So shortened week in the UK. And actually, I should have mentioned last week, this week, we also had the jobs numbers out of the US, which is pretty strong. But that usually means that the Monday and Tuesday are pretty quiet anyway. However, on the Wednesday, we've got the US inflation. So the next key event, the worry for markets would be if that comes in significantly higher than what's expected. The core inflation expectation at the moment is 5.5%. That's the magic number. Higher, worry, lower. That's what we want to see. Also, Chinese inflation, so that's still very low. Obviously, they're at a different part of their economic cycle compared to the other parts of the world. Bank of England policy decision expectation, 25 basis point hike as well. And then the MPC to sort of reiterate further hikes as long as inflation remains high, which it is. We also have the UK GDP number out at the latter part of the week. We've seen a very strong pound at the moment. Is that going to harm the Bank of England? We'll have to wait and see. The busiest weeks earnings wise are behind us, but we still got a couple of big names reporting next week. Well-known names such as Berkshire Hathaway, PayPal, Airbnb, Toyota, Disney, all report. So still a busy one, but maybe not as excited as this week just gone by.
Thank you very much. Well, enjoy your bank holiday, Sam, and we will speak to you next week for another update.
You too, Simon. Speak soon.
Welcome back. The government has finally revealed new measures to tackle the scam epidemic. Action Fraud, which many have argued is simply not fit for purpose, is being wound down to be replaced with a £30 million new service. But, asks our Lee Boyce, will it work? Lee, you've been writing about this for many, many, many years. How bad is the situation with consumer fraud, and what was so wrong with Action Fraud?
Georgie, we've been covering this for a very long time, and I've been, you know, working for This Is Money now for best part of 14 years. And we have been at the forefront of scams in that whole time. It's been almost like a slow-moving car crash. It was quite clear that as more people were being pushed to do their banking, for example, online via apps and all of that kind of thing, that a problem was going to emerge in which scammers are going to wise up and start targeting people and stealing their money. And that's exactly what's happened. And it's taken a long, long time, it feels, for there to be some actual sensible kind of measures being planned and being put in place to start trying to get on top of this. Now, consumer fraud is a massive problem. It makes up 2 in 5 crimes now in England and Wales. I mean, it's a £7 billion a year problem for Britain. And the thing is, it's got to the point now where I have sympathy with banks. That's not a sentence you're going to hear that often from me, but I have sympathy from banks where they people being defrauded, and banks have put in more measures. So, for example, two-factor authentication, and when you go to make payments online, whether or not the account number matches up with the payee, for example, and warnings of fraud. Are you sure that you're making this payment and it's going to who you think it's going to? There's been a whole wave of measures that banks have brought in. Now, whenever I speak to banking sort of insiders, head of fraud departments, that kind of thing, they all kind of say a couple of things. Firstly, there's not enough joined up thinking between all of the players that are involved here. So I'm talking the banks, the telecoms firms, social media sites, and other big tech, because a lot of scams originate from social media and from big tech. And it feels like because these companies are all so massive, there's not enough joined up thinking. There's not enough going on to actually go, do you know what? We should all be working together here and tackling this problem and sorting it out. Even today, the TSB has come out and said 4 in 5 scams originate from Meta-owned companies. So Facebook, Instagram, WhatsApp, it's huge. This is the kind of thing that I was being told at the end of last year, kind of off the record, essentially that there's a lot of low level but high quantity scams that are coming from Facebook Marketplace, for example. It's absolutely snowballed. So while something like an investment fraud is way more beneficial to a scammer because they're more likely to take sort of 50 grand plus, they can attack people through social media. And if they're getting 500 quid, £1,000 managing to scam people that way, it can be just as beneficial and an easier kind of target. So there's a lot of play, there's a lot going on. I have been probably one of the biggest critics of action fraud over the last decade, because the whole issue with action fraud is that essentially it's a reporting service. So if you get scammed, you phone up action fraud and it kind of logs it, but it doesn't really do anything with it. And that in there lies the problem, because people think that it's being dealt with or something's going on behind the scenes, but simply put, it just doesn't do that. And a lot of this fraud does originate from overseas. It's big gangs that are stealing money. They take it overseas and money's never to be seen again. And then you've got cross jurisdiction kind of policing and all that kind of thing. It gets very messy and it's very, very complicated. Mm. So actually, the best thing to do is to try and tackle it at source. You know, you're trying to cut this down at the real low, you know, start of where this all originates from. Now, last year, do you remember that ice spoof stuff? They had the police, when they cracked down on that gang, they made a load of arrests. I think that's still all ongoing. But that made they made 3 million scam calls, texts, and it was a very lucrative business. That kind of thing needs to be cracked down even further. So the government measures, what they're talking about here is, as you say, action fraud was going anyway, and they're going to replace it with a different body. Now, will that body go far enough? Now, what they're suggesting here is having a portal, for example. So if you're defrauded, you can actually keep track on your kind of case and what's happening with your case. That could be a step in the right direction. And they're talking about cracking down on SIM farms. Now, what that means is it's quite cheap devices in which people can make these scam texts and calls and all of that kind of thing. And it's cracking down and finding where these things are originated from. A lot of people that the scammers that do this are proper sophisticated gangs that even have almost like offices, and they move around every few weeks. And it's a professional organization. You know, they're sitting around with crib sheets, phoning people, trying to defraud them by pretending that they're calling from their bank, calling from whoever organization it is. And that's another thing that needs to be sort of cracked down on. And Ofcom are doing that. So there's going to be much stricter rules around spoofing and making sure that calls that are coming from overseas, for example, are more likely to be blocked. And they're even talking about just completely banning financial cold calling, even from genuine companies, because people can't tell the difference. These scammers are so sophisticated and so good at what they do that it is almost impossible to differentiate between what is a genuine call from a financial firm that might actually be trying to sell you something that's good to a scammer that is going to completely rinse you and take you for what it's worth. But it's going to be a big, big task, Georgie, because the crux of it all was getting those four major sort of companies sorted, the banks, telecoms firms, big tech, social media. Can they all come together in a room and say, this is billions and billions and billions of pounds worth of fraud. What on earth are we going to do? And it just, it feels like this is something that the government should have really had a dedicated minister for, a dedicated kind of like set of rules for a long time ago, because we launched Beat the Scammers on This Is Money 7 years ago, a section of the website where we basically, we were reporting on so many different scams, so many different frauds, that we kind of wanted to collate them in one place and say, do you know what? If you keep reading this bit of the website and it helps one person where you go, actually, I've read that and I'm pretty certain that that's a scam. It's all about taking your time and making sure that you know that what you're doing, don't ever feel rushed. I think that's the thing. And that's how they play up on all this kind of thing. And the more we can arm people with knowledge and kind of tell people and warn people, the better. But it has still, you know, it's only so much we can do. Yeah. This requires a real high level intervention. And the thing is now is, if there's then a change of government, for example, next year, does it just get kicked down, the can get kicked down the road even more? This is a massive problem in this country. It's absolutely huge. There's a lot of people that fall victim to scams, fraud, that just won't even admit that they have, because
I was going to say, you said Action Fraud is a reporting service. I mean, that's if people report it at all, because we know that lots of people just don't.
Exactly, Georgie, exactly that. And you know, the proof will be in the pudding. Will we see actual change? Will this problem be kind of grappled with better? Well, we'll see, but at least there's some murmurings. At least the Prime Minister seems to have got it on his radar, finally.
Indeed.
Someone's got to grab the bull by the horns and something has to be done.
Simon, can I ask you, in your position at This Is Money, for many, many years, are readers interested in reading about scams? The reason I mention this is because, as a freelancer, I've worked at many companies over the years. I've been asked to speak on radio and TV, and it seems to my mind nobody wants to talk about it. It's just not, I don't know if it's because it's sort of only stupid people get scammed idea, and therefore it's not something that we want to talk about. I know it's something you've covered a lot on This Is Money, but I don't know. What do you think?
These kinds of scams are the kind of thing that people think only happens to other people apart from them until it happens to them. I think it is a general rule. Now, what that can mean is that people are less interested perhaps in reading stories that warn them about scams than maybe they should be. But they are always interested in reading stories about other people being scammed. And I think that shows why, if it does happen to you, or if it does happen to people, then it's good to speak up, because by telling people about this, it helps mean that it might not happen again to somebody else. So the one of the more recent ones that's been happening quite a lot is the mum and dad WhatsApp scam.
Yeah.
Which is,
mum got one yesterday.
Yeah, the fake message from child, I've run out of money, or my card's been stolen, you know, I need your help, that kind of thing. And you know, that the lots of people get caught out by things like that. They look very convincing. As Lee said, the fraudsters are, you know, they're pretty professional, and it's pretty convincing, and sharing the story helps other people get stopped. It may not get you your money back, sadly, but also you just need to be super, super careful. Anytime anybody asks you to transfer any money whatsoever, be as suspicious as you possibly can, particularly if you don't know that person. If somebody phones you up from any organization and asks you to transfer money to an account, just don't do it. And if you've got any doubt in your mind about something, go check with someone that you know and trust. Everybody's got that person that they ask questions about financial stuff or things like that. We've all got one of those. The person that we see is like, oh yeah, I'll ask them about it. Take a beat, go ask them. Don't be panicked. Trust me, your bank will never phone you up in a panic and tell you to transfer some money to another account. just doesn't happen, that kind of
your
thing.
Your child might, but
but even then, you know, just go sense check it. And often it comes down to sense checking, and the banks are still a little bit, they hide behind some of the rules. You know, they hide behind some of the, well, they put in the passcode and so therefore they transferred the money themselves. And so don't think that they will always give you your money back. In many cases they will, and they have got better at it, but they still don't do quite enough monitoring for suspicious transactions. We still get loads of stories from people who say, look, I mean, you know, how did they not stop this? This is totally out of kilter with how I would normally use my bank account. But then we also get stories about people who get payments blocked and who get angry at their bank when they're trying to send payments. And they say that my bank's trying to stop me sending my own money. So, you know, those two things are related.
Indeed. I'm just laughing, Simon, because actually it was 6 hours ago that I got a message from Mum. I just got a text saying phone is broken and new number, obviously a scam, Mum. I've taught her well, but I like the passive aggressive a bit later on. I read it. I was going to ignore it. It was addressed to Mum. None of my children send me texts anyway. Thanks, Mum. Right. Finally, Simon, very quickly, it's happened. Savings rates have breached the 5% mark. So long as you're willing to fix for a year or more. We did it. We reached 5%. Are they going to go higher than this? And where are the best ones to be found?
We told you this was going to happen last week. We did gaze into our crystal ball and say that they were probably going to breach 5% and maybe quite soon. Lo and behold, this week they did. Savers can now get 5%. The interesting thing is they can now get 5% for a fix of the year, right? Which is quite an interesting one, because actually, as we remarked last week, there is this curious situation where you are currently getting paid more money to fix your savings over the short term than you are to fix your savings over the long term. And this is an indication of the fact that banks in general think that rates are going to rise and they're going to peak in the short term and then they're going to come down. The top deals are the same over 1 year and 5 year, but that's an unusual situation in itself. But on a kind of aggregate level, you're getting better rates over the short term. Should you lock your money away at 5% for a year? I mean, that's a pretty good rate. It's a pretty good rate of return guaranteed on your money. Make sure you've got the FSCS protection, £85,000, all that other stuff, all the other checks you do. But 5% is pretty good.
Not bad. Not bad at all. Right, that's it for this week. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon.
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney, and you can join in the debate in reader comments and see all podcast paths at thisismoney.co.uk/podcast.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Don't forget, you can stay on top of what's going on in the markets by tuning in to the Digest and Invest podcast by eToro. Go to your regular podcast platform and listen on the go. Digest and Invest by eToro, the podcast for those interested in trading and investing.